long-awaited episode of Masters of Our Domain. Made it happen. I know this was like the worst scheduling week for both of us, so we managed to find the overlap of time that worked.
Yeah, this was. I'm extremely happy that we have finally found a time to talk, because I feel like this is actually a good episode. We're fresh. We're ready to pod. Like this is this has been a tremendously productive time. In a whole bunch of different ways, and we have a
been sat around in the sun in Sydney.
So, where does Sydney rank in your list of global cities? You've traveled much more widely than I have. I'm curious.
Well, Sydney, I don't know. It has like it has kind of fucked vibes. It has a beautiful climate. Like honestly, compared to like Brisbane, which I actually think is a more kind of fun city, it feels a bit less fake. Like. But Sydney, I got out of the airport and I'm walking down the street and I'm like, oh, this is like the perfect temperature. It's like 25 degrees. It's sunny. There's like a light breeze. The humidity is low. Whereas I've been in Brisbane where it was like 30 degrees and like 90% humidity. And you're sat in the shade drinking a pint and you're sweating. You're sweating like you're running track. Like it's brutal up there.
Being outside in that kind of climate is an act in itself. It's an activity in itself. It's like, why is a big part of culture in the southern United States like sitting somewhere and talking? Because that is the activity. Like you can't do that and go for a brisk walk. Like you're not power walking in that kind of heat and humidity. Like, does New Orleans have a long distance social walking culture? I kind of doubt it.
Yeah, it would be so far. Unless you're walking to somewhere where the weather is more conducive to walking, a really long distance walk. It's so funny in Australia because everyone's always like, oh, I could never live in Melbourne. The weather's so bad. And I'm like, no, there's nowhere with bad weather in Australia, not compared to what I'm used to. Like, that's why Melbourne's my favorite, because it's like, it has kind of a discernible winter in a way that most Australian major cities don't. But I'm fine with that because the winter is mild and every other time of the year is like actively nice. It's like
it's winter in the sense that it is variety relative to the baseline, not in the sense. Not in the sense that it is actively bad. Okay, so what city, but you said the vibes are kind of fucked. Why are the vibes kind of fucked?
It's like, well, I was actually texting a friend in the UK about this idea. I was like, it's like LA run by the Germans.
Mm-hmm. Like, okay.
It has like LA vibes. It's like very kind of like, you know, big wide roads, like sunshine. It's got that kind of crisp, dry heat, like the beach, whatever. But it has that, unlike any American city, it has a real like, rules. It's a rules place. It's like, and all of Australia is like this a bit, but I feel like Sydney is the most like everyone's like head empty, pure vibes. They're like, yeah, I get up, I go to the gym, I go to the beach, I oil my torso, I go to bed at 10 p.m. All the bars shut at 9:30 p.m. Like I'm eating a fucking poke bowl. Like I'm jogging shirtless. Like the amount of people I saw jogging shirtless on my walk. And I'm like, get a hold of yourself. What are you doing? I mean, and admittedly, these guys were shredded. But I'm just like, why? What are you on the fucking make Milo Edwards feel bad about himself? Beat? Like, what is this?
So where I live is also a big running shirtless place. And I think that ought to be illegal, not because it is inherently bad, but because it does make me feel bad. I'm like, this is ridiculous. Like, you know, like you don't get to make me feel this way. That should be illegal. Isn't that on the basis of how people have historically made laws actually not a bad way to go about doing it? Like that makes me feel icky. And so that
sort of George V type lawmaking. I know George IV. That was the one I'm thinking. You should, when you see someone running shirtless near you, you should pick up a huge boulder and then just lay it in their path.
The thought has occurred to me, the Phoenix is a place that has a lot of what I would call like culture of the body, and people are very into their bodies and showing off their bodies, and it's and people spend a lot of time on them and a lot of money on their bodies here. Like it's a whole thing that people do of all social classes. It's really pervasive in the culture. But
it's hot weather culture also.
Yeah,
because like your body is just going to be more on display. Not an issue in the United Kingdom.
No,
not an issue at all.
No, the United Kingdom has a great second layer policy. as far as that's concerned. Like, there's
until you get like north of a certain point. Like, I was in, which is so funny because it's where the body should be out less. But I was in Glasgow the other week. Oh my! It was just before I came to Australia. It was March the 12th, and it was like maybe 13 degrees, and I saw a shirtless guy.
Yeah, sure, sure. Mm-hmm.
There were like people wandering around in t-shirts and shorts. I had a coat on. Like, it was cold. relish it.
Is Glasgow like the American Midwest? Is it like a Milwaukee or like a Great Lakes city? Is that the Glasgow parallel?
Yeah, maybe. I think I haven't spent enough time in the Midwest. I do like the defining features of Glasgow are it is not London in a very like pointed way. Like, it's very like there's a thing about like Scottish culture, which is like it's pointedly not English culture. Mm-hmm. And that means that they're right quite a lot of the time. They're not necessarily right for the right reasons, but they do. There's a kind of weird like communitarian thing going on in Glasgow, which you don't really get in, certainly in the south of England. And there's also, I think, in a more recent phenomenon is that a lot of like people in the arts and stuff have moved from the south of England to Glasgow because it's cheap, but still kind of like has a bit of a, there is like culture there, and you can kind of lead a sort of like life in the arts there. It's possible, and it's kind of just more economically feasible. And also because, again, and I think this is in some ways a response to Englishness. Like, there's a vibe in Glasgow, which I like, to the Glaswegian listeners, this is not a complaint, but like where they're like, we're actually cultured, okay, so we can handle it. All right, show us the pretentious thing. We'll watch it. Yeah. All right, go on. So I'm hard enough for this. Yeah, like there's a kind of, and so like the sort of thing where like English people would almost sneer at something for being like artsy, or I think there's an element of which like Glaswegians are, they're alive to the fact that people would like to perceive them as not being cultured. So they're cultured in an almost reflexive way to almost to prove a point.
I love that. But yeah. Okay. So that's really interesting. And it actually ties directly into something I was thinking about a lot in this episode of Barbarians, season one, episode two, which is defining oneself in opposition to other groups, which is kind of the basis of the whole Roman barbarian dichotomy. It's right there in the title of the show. And I'm really happy. That's a natural segue. Because love it when things really come around.
To the listener, none of this is deliberate. This is real savant podcasting from us.
Yeah, just I would call it like lightly structured idiocy.
Yeah, definitely lighter on structure than it is on idiocy. But yeah, there's no need to do an introduction today. Whatever, we've kind of covered it. We're talking about Barbarians season one, episode two. I watched both episodes because obviously I missed out on the episode one discussion, although I did edit it, so I am aware of what transpired. I'm aware that we're giving children the big bonk on the head that turns them into a podcaster. My son's really into the Joe Rogan Experience now after a Roman centurion hit him with the hilt of his gladius.
I mean, honestly, the overlap between teenaged brain trauma and Joe Rogan listenership, like that's a non-statistically unimportant correlation right there.
100%.
I say this as a man who experienced some teenaged traumatic brain injuries. So like, I'm not coming at this from a place of lacking empathy.
Joe Rogan Experience is CTE. That's what he experienced.
I mean, it doesn't have to be full blown CTE, but definitely like some associated symptoms of repetitive head injuries.
Yeah,
like you can only diagnose CTE after death when you get in there and you got to actually look at the brain under a microscope. So let's say
there's a much quicker way to do it, which is looking at their podcast listening history, and it's less invasive as well.
Yeah, that's the real Cambridge Analytica right there. That's the real large scale data work is to be found in court. See, this is why we need AI to build gigantic medical databases so that we can discover these kinds of correlations.
Yeah. I think that would work. That would work pretty well. What was I gonna? Because you know, George Foreman died.
Yes, very sad about this. This is huge for me personally, as both a boxing fan and a consumer who really enjoyed the George Foreman grill.
I hope they bury him in a big grill. Well, this wasn't even what I was going to say about George Foreman, but now that you bring this up, George Foreman, relatively recently, like within the last couple of years, I was speaking to someone my age, I'm not sure who it was, and I referred to George Foreman fighting Muhammad Ali, and they went, "What, the grills guy?" And I'm like, "Well," and I was like, "Well, yeah, but like he was a boxer." And then they were like, no, he's the guy who made the grills. I'm like, no, George Foreman, the boxer, and George Foreman, the man who made the grills, are the same man. Did you think he was famous for making grill? Like someone invented a grill and they got George Foreman to sell it because he was a famous boxer. He's not a man who's famous for inventing a grill. That's why he sells the grill, because he was already famous. And they were like, and it was an odd marketing decision, but my God, did it work?
I mean, okay, so now that is a hilarious way to come at life, is being imagine being in a place in the world where you know George Foreman solely as a grill salesman. And not as having had this entire separate life. Like, that's
the overlap between George Foreman and Nelly and Paul Wall is known for their grills in the mid 2000s.
I'm loving that. I'm loving the free association with grilling right here that we're doing. Because we could go on with this. We could go off with that for a while. Okay. So Barbarians. We're watching it. There's been a major.
Oh, wait, sorry. So what I was going to say about George Foreman, sorry, because that was the thing that you made me think of about George Foreman. I'm being Phoebe now on this episode. No, so the George Foreman thing that I was going to say was someone had done this post about George Foreman being like, yeah, George Foreman 4 years ago was being used as a vaccine ambassador and now he's dead. It's a shame what they've done to these people. No one will ever look into it. And someone was like, quote tweeted and was like, yes, the man who was punched in the head for a living has died at the tender age of 76, but vaxxed? ?
That's a good ass post.
Yeah, that is the destiny of the Joe Rogan Experience listener.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, here's the thing. I think for a certain kind of dude, 76 is a great lifespan. Like, are we adding a lot of value with years 76 to 88? Sometimes, sure, absolutely.
Yeah. If you're Julio Iglesias, maybe.
I mean,
Berlusconi, sure. If you can still bunga.
If the blind Doge of Venice who sacked Constantinople age 90.
That is pretty cool. I mean, so embarrassing to get sacked by the blind guy.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, you can't even see what you're sacking. Like that's a major obstacle to overcome in your sacking pursuits is a lack of eyesight.
Yeah, it's a real flex.
Yeah,
blind sacking.
Yeah, disabled community hero.
No scoping the city of Constantinople. the fucking blind Doge is using an aimbot.
That can't be allowed. Okay, so we've gone through George Foreman.
We should talk about
we've gone through George Foreman via bonks on the head. And
absolutely.
This gets season one, episode two. The first episode involved a bonking and an eagle stealing.
Bonking American sense, not bonking British sense. Just
does bonking mean?
Bonking is like an old timey word for having sex.
Really?
It's like one of those newspaper words that you only read in the newspaper, but like a certain type of newspaper, you know, where it's like, it would be like David Beckham bonking secretary in steamy 72-hour hotel romp, you know, like that, where they're just using like a million words that you would never use in a sentence. Yeah. In the headline of an article. Yeah. Bonking is very much one of those. There was a British headline that went viral on like American Twitter years ago, because no one could believe it was real. And it was about one of Boris Johnson's affairs, and someone had written an opinion piece in like the Times or the Telegraph, and the headline was, "Only a plonker would call time on sozzled bonking." I'm like, this makes perfect sense to me as a sentence, but I realize that it is objectively insane.
I mean, I feel like, okay, this is where context clues come in handy, because I know I can figure out like a couple of the words, and then I think about the rest of them and I'm like, okay, let's take apart the etymologies here. It takes me a little while, but I can get it. American English is not so far removed from British English that I can't get there, but it's not a natural act of translation for me.
Yeah. Yeah. It's strange. And this is why American English is much easier to learn, because it's like there's so many like tributaries in British English, which almost never get used. It's like Greece in the 50s, where you've got some people who are still speaking like Katharevousa, like biblical Greek, but like, and like no one actually speaks it. And that's like newspaper English. Like it just goes off into like fucking like, you know, plonkers, sozzle bonking. And then, you know, your average language student is like, none of these words have ever come up in a textbook.
American English is simpler though, because the primary determinant of language change and language variety is time depth. So because English has been spoken in England and elsewhere in the Isles for a long time, that's had a lot of time to accumulate changes at a local and regional level. So, but when you then take those dialects to a new or varieties to a new place and plonk them down where they have had less time, they have accumulated that's why the most divergent varieties of American English are all found on the East Coast, because those are the places that were settled first. The further west the more generic and kind of lacking distinctive features American English is. Also true of the Latin language, by the way. As it spread through the Roman Empire, it did eventually accumulate regional changes. But what's really remarkable about it is how even at this popular...
Sorry, give me 1 second.
Yeah.
No housekeeping, thank you.
Sorry.
Big dick hotel stayer here, refusing
housekeeping.
This is
such a bad hotel.
That makes it so much funnier.
For the benefit of the listener, I'm not like loaded or anything, but I generally, when I'm traveling for work, I treat it as a reasonable expense to get myself a hotel that is nice enough. But sometimes hotels.com leads me astray. And normally I have the fucking platinum hotels.com membership. Normally I'm staying somewhere nice at a good discount. On this occasion, they have fucked me in the ass. They made the hotel look nice on the website. It is not nice.
Is there anything good about the hotel? Is the location at least solid?
It's central, yeah. It's not like gross. It's just like very sort of it feels like the sort of hotel you would go to cheat on your wife, you know?
Yeah, no.
Like,
I know
look at where this TV is relative to the bed. And it's mounted on a sort of like perspex, like paisley patterned, like wall plate thing. There's like a mirror that's like, it's like painted silver, but it's got like a kind of Regency style frame. It's a bit sex hotel.
Yeah, I know the vibe. I stayed in a place like that in the financial district in New York not that long ago. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
People
be cheating on their wives in the financial district.
Oh yeah, and like surrounded by bodegas. A lot of what I would call like affordable low-grade dick pills on sale in the nearby bodegas. A lot of that vibe in that area.
Affordable dick pill, the working man's dick pill.
The working, like, it's all been co-opted by Big Pharma now. There used to be some honor and some direct to consumer experience.
We used to make dick pills right here in the Bronx. My uncle made dick pills.
So there's a guy running for mayor of New York who seems genuinely awesome, but he makes all sorts of very clever and interesting videos about how politics impacts the lives of average people in New York City. And he did one on how the permitting system for halal carts has led to a $2 increase in the price of chicken over rice, and how this cost has been passed on to the consumer by a parasitic class of people who are controlling the flow of permits to halal cart vendors. And I'm like, okay, so this is brilliant. I would like to believe that we can once again have regional dick pill entrepreneurs in the United States of America, that every man can make his own dick pill. That's the RFK Jr. dream, I think. That is.
You've heard of the Hard Rock Cafe. What about the Rock Hard Cafe?
This whole country, if we try hard enough, could be sporting rock hard erections. That's the RFK Jr. promise. Honestly, that
I'm from Hard On, Idaho, which was founded by the William Dick Pill in the 1890s. Yeah, the whole town is named after him.
Yeah, with his partner Jeffrey Viagra. The two of them made a formidable team.
Jeffrey Viagra just makes you think of like a version of Jeremy Fragrance, but he's rating dick pills.
I mean, this is a great, there are two wolves inside you. One of them is the gas station dick pill and the other is Viagra.
Either way, you're getting rock hard. And you're going, power! My father died!
I was thinking about this lately, and I've discovered that Donald Trump's most fervent base of support is really like white Gen X men. That's really the people who are most likely to go full MAGA. And
some people who love fucking Teslas.
The same people who love Teslas and the same people who are extremely apt to be swayed by dick pills, who are extremely likely to be like the targeted person for a dick pills ad. Like that is the demographic that is most into Donald Trump. And I say,
and
this
if you're
is
driving
like,
a Tesla, what do you need dick pills for? Come on.
That because the stress of work is so much, you know, sometimes
I need to take dick pills so I can crank it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's like, look, you know, Cialis would make masturbation that much more fun. I think that's the promise right there. Okay, so Barbarians, season one, episode two. So one of the things that I really enjoyed about this episode, the way that Varys, the Roman bigwig, slash adoptive father to our main character Adi, the way that he repeatedly refers to the guy as Barbare, as a barbarian when he's talking to him, and
they're using the vocative, they know their shit.
Yeah, that's true. I it's one of the things I really appreciate about this show is they got the Latin right. It's really good. It's good.
This is something I find kind of spooky about it, because it's obviously like, I mean, my Latin has atrophied a bit, but I technically have a degree in Latin. And then watching it, but Latin is like, you never hear it spoken, or like if you do hear it spoken, it's in quite a sterile like academic context where like people are like reading out text.
Yeah.
And there's like, I mean, the way that they're pronouncing it is quite like Italiano, which I guess is them kind of like matching the freak of the German being. Because I mean, they're not speaking fucking ancient Germanic dialects, but they're doing like modern German. But and so I was kind of like, is this right? It's like hard to like, the Latin itself is right, but I'm like, is the vibe right? The guy playing Varys is like so Italian. He reminds my sister used to go out with this Italian guy, but like Guido Italian from Essex, like the British version of like a minor Sopranos character. And this guy is exactly like his dad. Like, he's the spitting image of him. He talks the same. Incredible.
That is a widespread archetype in Italy still. I mean, you can find that guy, like, that guy probably owns a chain of cafes in Milan. He has some shady dealings in the garment industry in Naples. Like, that guy really is a pan-Italian archetype. You can find find him anywhere. But in this age, 2000 years ago, because of the vagaries of history, this man's ancestors were Roman legates and provincial governors and office holders.
Yeah. And so the big plot line of the episode is that like the one of the main actually of his sort of like right hand man, junior officers, is the son of one of the German tribal leaders who was given over to the custody of Rome as a sort of peace offering, to be like, well, you raise my son and then I won't destroy Rome because my son is a Roman now. Kind of insane. And then there's this like weird, so his name is Ari, his German name, but then he's become like Arminius, the Roman, like, I don't know what his rank is supposed to be.
Military tribune, something like that would make sense.
Cause yeah, like they're calling him an officer, which is a bit of a, I feel like is a bit of a modern anachronism in that way, where like the Roman army, kind of the distinction between like soldiers and officers, I feel like was a bit of a murky one. There were ranks, but
yeah. So Roman officers basically fell into two categories. So you have centurions who are, my understanding is that centurions are generally promoted out of the ranks. Like they may come from more prominent families to start with, but the centurions are usually a product of kind of the social institution of the army.
They're hard geezers. They've fought their way to the top. Yeah.
Yeah. You can find these guys in every professional army that has ever existed on the face of the planet. It's the same guy. They're master sergeants in the Marine Corps in the United States. They're like riflemen during the Napoleonic Wars. Like these guys have always existed.
These are the guys who are fucking training people at Sandhurst, walking around with a swagger stick and insisting on being called colors, like snapping their heels together, and you know,
because these dudes are fully institutionalized. And you can see this in the archaeological and textual record of the Roman army. It's a really interesting thing. It becomes more so over time, but even by this period that we're talking about here, the first century AD, there is a military culture that is kind of separate from civilian culture. Like the Roman army as an institution is not Roman society as a whole. It's this whole kind of parallel world that interacts with the civilian world, but it is also its own thing. It's much more in contact with the barbarian world than your average Roman is. And this is becoming more true precisely during the period that we're talking about. The increasing use of auxiliaries, the large scale recruitment from beyond the frontiers. So the army is in the process of transforming into a thing that is almost like a middle ground between the barbarian world and the Roman world. This is one of the really interesting ways of thinking about the Roman frontier that I think makes a lot of sense, is to see it as a zone in itself. So instead of being a barrier between two worlds, you view the frontier as a distinct kind of belt that runs for a good distance on either side of whatever the nominal frontier is. And that frontier culture, because it's a place where people from a whole bunch of different groups are coming together and fighting and interacting and having kids and like trading, all of this stuff, it becomes a really kind of interesting place in itself. So this show, that becomes more true as we get into the later period of the Roman Empire. But shows like this, and this period that it's discussing, is when the frontier is coming into existence. So,
because we're set in like what, very, very early first century AD here?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is like 9 AD.
Right. Yeah.
So the Roman army is already becoming its own thing. It's coming into increasingly regular contact with the barbarian world beyond the frontiers. So the use of the term barbarian as kind of an insult or a put down, like not only does it reflect Roman attitudes toward barbarians, but for them, this is a time when barbarians are like becoming a real and regular presence as opposed to an occasional threat. Rome's ways of dealing with things in the past was generally the application of massive violence followed by withdrawal. And in this period, the Romans are going and they're finding places where they can kind of set limits, places that they can defend. So instead of going out and trying to conquer everything all the time, or at least having plans for expansion in every direction that you might take up, Rome is becoming a more solidified thing. It's becoming the entity we know as the Roman Empire.
Yeah, and it's also kind of laying the groundwork for, I think, something which is perhaps is very known to people who study this stuff, but is like perhaps not commonly known about the Roman Empire, which is like how integrated it was, and like the way in which like Rome's ultimate strategy for like hanging on to its empire was like making people speak Latin and making people effectively Roman, and ultimately making people Roman citizens in a way that was like politically controversial at the time. But it was sort of their way of like, well, they're not going to fight us if they are us.
Yeah. It's Romanization is this really fascinating process because, yeah, to your point, we have to remember that even as the Roman army is penetrating this deep into what's now Germany, the area behind it in Gaul has only been Roman under even the loosest Roman control for 50 or 60 years. And for the most part, the way that that integration takes place is not through the continuous application of violence. It's entirely peaceful. It is people in different places adopting the symbols of Romanness, local elites, especially. So local bigwigs deciding that they're going to teach their kids Latin. They're going to start living in nice country villas. They're going to learn rhetoric. They're going to set up a town council and run for office. They're going to make themselves into local elites on the Roman style. And so around this time, you get all of these towns pop up in the archaeological record that are built along Roman lines. They have kind of a standard package of buildings. They've got a bathhouse. They have a little theater. They've got a forum. Like they're like cookie cutter little Roman suburbs, or like kind of the equivalent of the suburbs that get built all over the United States in the 1950s, 60s, 70s. It's a settlement type that spreads very rapidly and organically throughout this whole big territory. So when you have guys like the kind of our main villain in this episode, Segestes, right, who is the father of Thusnelda. Guys like Segestes existed all over the place, and the only reason that Rome worked,
fucking rat cunts, fucking dog and the boys.
Yeah, it's honestly guys who were like, you know what, this Rome stuff isn't so bad. I'll cut my deal with them. I get to stay an important person, and I learn Latin. I teach my kids Latin. I get to be an important guy here still. I just now have access to another additional source of power and prestige. That's the bargain that local elites made all over the territory the Romans conquered. They're not going into every town like looting, pillaging, burning. They do that just often enough for you to know that that's a thing that they can do. And otherwise, it's you cutting deals. And the guy who's leading that army is expanding his own personal network. He's gaining these local elites as his own clients. So in the Roman world, this is something we've talked about in the past. There's a very strong patron client system. So you have a formal bond that ties you to someone above you in the social hierarchy. You do things for that person as a matter of personal loyalty and advantage, and they do things for you. It's in their interest to advance your career, right? Mm. So guys like Varus, as they're going out and they're doing conquests, these high-ranking Roman senators and equestrians, as they're going out and running these expeditions, they're making friends locally. They're the ones who are telling them, like, oh, you know, you got to teach your kids Latin. You got to send, you know what, send your son to Rome. I'll give him a full education. I'll get him a start. He can come back and then he'll take over from you. And, you know, 20 years down the road, that guy and all of his friends give money to build a town in this style. And that's the kind of the process that leads to the Roman Empire becoming Roman.
There's a pragmatism to it. Like, and you see that obviously like all empires are violent at their core and that is how they function. But there's like, you see that difference between, like, you compare that to like the way that, like, you know, at various ancient Greek city states would conceive of like running like colonies or whatever. And it's like completely different. It's just like, well, these people are like subhuman and we're going to subjugate them. Whereas like, it's like sort of like the difference between the French and the Belgians or something, you know, like the French went around the world going, you're French now, here's how you be French. And the Belgians were like, I'm cutting your fucking hand off. Like, there was like no, and they saw no need to like ever interact with them as people. Whereas the French, as nasty as they could be, were kind of like attempting to kind of like, oh, we want to make France big. It feels like the Romans are much more like that.
Yeah, those really are the two sides of imperialism. And they're different approaches to imperialism as a thing. And both of them can be highly effective. The kind of genocidal approach to imperialism has at certain points worked pretty well. like where you just kill all the people
I'm just
you don't like.
Gazing and... around Sydney, Australia, right now.
Yeah, I mean, they're like the much of the United States, a pretty genocidal kind of settler colonial projects.
Case of both the US and Australia, a lot of it even done accidentally because of disease. Yeah. Like it was something I read a statistic, like something like 60-odd% of Aboriginal people just died of like European diseases within the first like year or two of like European colonization, aside from the ones that were killed deliberately, which is plenty. But
yeah, the estimates of the death toll of European diseases on indigenous peoples in North and South America is of an extent to suggest that it was responsible for a global climate drop, because these people had been burning, they'd been doing things that impacted the global climate, but that the net effect of the loss of their activities was enough to have a spike in the global climate. And so a lot of what Europeans, when they showed up in the Americas and they saw what they understood to be like wasteland or unused land or unpeopled land, it was only unpeopled because yes, diseases had been through there first and had killed tens of thousands or millions of people. You don't see that as much with Rome and the barbarians, because there was already enough traffic in between those areas that they were pretty much part of the same disease ecology. So I'm sure that as our archaeological record gets better and more sites and human remains get tested for bacterial remains and viral remains, that we'll be able to see that in more detail. But it's not quite as much of a first contact situation with Rome and the barbarians. I'm sure to some extent, though, like the diseases of urbanism that wouldn't have been present, and of like having tons and tons of people packed really closely together. Like urbanism is in itself bad for people. That's one of Rome's great exports, is just cities that are net consumers of people. Anytime in the ancient
trying to
world.
Make you into a commuter.
Yeah.
You've got he's just hunting elk in the forest with a spear, and they're like, buddy, how would you like to use an abacus?
Yeah. Do you have any interest in stoking a kiln? What's your take on kiln stoking? and that, friends, is where slavery comes from.
Well, there's a line in this episode where the son who went to Rome and is now like a Roman officer, he turns up and he says they have things in Rome that you wouldn't believe. And it's very funny to like, because of how like to us all of this is so long ago, but even like what's happening in Rome is so like it's like the Jetsons if you're from like a Germanic village.
Oh yeah,
like that there's like running water, and there's like, you know, these kind of marble buildings and what have you, although not as many marble buildings at this point in history.
Yeah, it's 100% true. Like there are no cities at all in non-Roman or in non-Mediterranean Europe. They just don't exist. There are no like, and that is not like figuratively true. It is literally true. There is nothing that you would label an urban form in Europe north of the Alps before the Romans get there. There are nucleated settlements. There are seasonally important settlements. There are hill forts. There are villages. There are things that we might look at and call towns, but there are no cities with thousands or with like high thousands or tens of thousands of inhabitants. So even the idea of urbanism, if you grow up in Germania, is completely foreign to you. Especially because in Germania, people don't even like, yes, we have a village here, but lots of people in Germania don't even live in villages. They live in farmsteads. Like the settlement archaeology record of Germany beyond the Rhine in this period is largely scattered hamlets, farmsteads, like small groups of people living together. So it's a very different settlement pattern. And I think they've kind of captured the small scale of life in the Germanic world pretty well in this show. I think they've done a good job of that.
Yeah, and it's like when you think of those stats, like the city on Earth that overtook Rome, ancient Rome in size, was Victorian London.
Yep.
When you think that between like the collapse of like Roman society and then sort of what, like about 1400 years later, that was there was no city of that size again on Earth. So it kind of gives you an image of what it must have been like at the time to experience it.
Yeah. Could you even comprehend that? And I mean, and as you went to the scale would rise. So if you're going, let's say if you're going to Rome from Germania, you're young Arminius here or Adi, if you're going on this journey, you're seeing in towns and cities of increasing size that all of them are bigger than anything you've ever seen before. And then you get to Rome, which is the biggest thing that exists in the world to the east ever. In the world to the west of China. There's China and then there's Rome. Those are the only two things outside of that. And it's not a coincidence that Victorian London and Rome are the two that reach that peak, because they're both imperial cities and they depend on the extraction of resources and people from elsewhere. So Victorian London still up to, I think up until like the turn of the 20th century, still a net consumer of people. The fertility rate in the city is lower than the mortality rate. So you have to continuously import people just to keep the population steady, let alone growing.
Yeah, before it went woke. What's wrong with inhaling coal dust and leaded petrol fumes and only eating jelly deals?
Yeah,
fine.
Like there is a reason why like everybody died of respiratory ailments in those cities. They were just incredibly unhealthy places to live.
What if actually when you're smoking a cigarette, that is damaging your lungs less because it's actually filtering the air a bit?
Yeah, that's the best argument for filtered cigarettes I've ever heard. It's like, do you live in a place with terrible air quality? Try a filter. Like that's actually brilliant. I mean, maybe we can bring Philip Morris back from the dead with that. campaign. Yet another reason why we should be glad the EPA is gone. Great opportunity to make money on that.
I mean, speaking of empires in decline.
Jesus Christ, man. Like, do you know how fucking funny it is? Like, just hilarious to me as a human being that I've spent most of my life like studying decaying empires and falling societies and things of that nature. And now I just get to live through this shit. Like, that's like, that's a great cosmic joke.
Yeah, it's funny actually, being, because in the UK at the moment, I mean, it's kind of like the sort of, you know, the fascia on the rise, but it's kind of a libocracy. But it's just like, it's you know, libocracy with like extremely crumbling public services and polity. But then actually looking at what's happening in America, as much as it is to a large extent the libs' fault, I'm like, fuck, I miss the libs. God, yeah. Fair play to the libs. It was better before.
It's like you have on the spectrum of senile presidents that we're working with, like Joe Biden, maybe our best senile president.
Yeah. I think and that very limited praise is one that we can mete out.
Yeah.
Out of the two senile presidents, he's the better one.
Oh, no. Reagan. Also senile.
Senile at the time? I mean, he certainly went senile sure.
Yeah, no, by 86, 87, I think he was pretty much not there anymore.
Nancy sucked it right out of him.
Neck game so strong, it gave the man Alzheimer's.
Neck game.
I mean.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, Nancy.
Fuck me.
Oh, Nancy. Yeah.
Nancy.
Would that she had filleted a better man?
Yeah. Yeah. Fuck me. She wouldn't. I don't know. It seems not good. And it seems like it's a sea change in not good. From the previous type of American not good, which was more or less contiguous with the ways in which America had been not good for a very long time. We've moved into new uncharted territory types of not good.
Yeah, it's pretty wild to know that I have paid tax dollars that are being spent deporting people to a maximum security third prison run by a third world dictator. That's fucking wild, man. Like, yeah. I just paid taxes. Like, that's that one has hit me.
Yeah. It feels like there's a certain type of person on the left who has kind of like lathed this into existence. Like, I'm not blaming people on the left for this. That's not the kind of point that I'm making. I just mean, like, there's a certain person who's believed that America was like this for years, and now it has actually become true. So they've sort of become right in a sort of, like, I can remember a few years ago, and people say this about Britain too, which is even crazier, where they'll be like, actually, protesting in Britain is just as dangerous as protesting in Russia. And it's like, no, it's not. What are you talking about? But then now America's like, hold my beer.
Yeah. So the guy that Trump appointed to run his counterterrorism center is a two-time failed congressional candidate and former special forces guy named Joe Kent. He ran for Congress in my parents' district and lost twice to one of the worst Democrats in the House. Her name is Marie Glusenkamp Perez. Sucks.
Washington, baby. Come on.
Yeah, this is, and Clark County is not like a nice place for the most part. There is a certain appeal to fascist politics there, but Joe Kent is probably the most out and out fascist guy who has tried to worm his way into American public life in a long time. And so Trump appointed him to run his counterterrorism center. And this guy he's been connected to various far right groups. He's participated in all sorts of anti-protest activity in Portland, which is just across the river from there. You don't appoint that guy unless you're going to declare protesters to be terrorists and you're looking for a guy who will order someone to pull the trigger. And it's wild being in a country where you know that that's the case and you know who that guy is. Like, he's intimately familiar to you, and you're like waiting for that guy to be put in a position where he does something terrible, knowing that that's a possibility in a way that it wasn't 6 months
finally
ago.
America's getting its Sulla.
So there is a segment of the right that has been calling for an American Sulla for a while now. The very online American right who have been kind of obsessed with the idea of a Sulla. J.D. Vance is connected to people in this group. There's a very kind of Silicon Valley vibe to it.
And I don't know if people thought this during the time of Sulla, but this is definitely something I'm thinking a lot about it now, which is like, I hate that the people who are doing this are such fucking nerds. Just every time I have to see Elon Musk doing anything, I'm like, it is an affront to God that this man is still alive and somehow in charge.
Yeah.
Like, he's so insultingly a loser. Like, I can't, you know, it feels like, at least if it was jocks doing it, there'd be an element of like, fine, the school bullies are in charge. But like, someone should be bullying him. That's what I feel most strongly about. We need to send a school bully into the White House.
Yeah, that's part of the problem here. I think about this a lot because I spent a lot of time around kind of unwarrantedly confident white dudes of a certain social class. And I'm like, the problem here is that nobody punched you in the face when you were like 17. Like, you didn't talk shit to the wrong person at the wrong time and have that person punch you. And then you have to do some hard thinking about who you are and the way that you interact with people. This just never happened for those guys. And if you go through life with that, having never happened to you, having never kind of gotten like up, like having to rethink where you are and who you are, and you're a sociopath, then the world is full of opportunities for you. If you just never internalize the idea that you could be wrong or that you could lose, then
a version of Sliding Doors where I go back to fucking Cape Town in like 1993 and punch Elon Musk in the face, and then it changes the trajectory of his life forever. He's like, we should free Nelson Mandela, actually.
Could you imagine knocking apartheid out of Elon Musk?
Yeah. It's like, he just gets punched in the face one time and he just becomes a reasonable man.
I mean, I would like to live in a world where there just was that button. You could just boop, and you just hit it there, and like, no more fascism. That would be great.
Yeah. There's no need to kill him as a baby. There's actually a simpler solution. You just got to punch him in the face as a teenager.
Honestly, there is nothing worse than a boy with bullying instincts and a persecution complex. Like I've met like seven of this guy in my life, and none of them have turned out well. Like they're like people who think the world is ganging up on them, but really they're the ones who are like lashing out at the world and making people miserable. And they wonder why they're alone and they don't have friends and why people don't like them. And it's like, well, you're the problem, man. Like, have you ever, I just know this type of guy so well. And while on the one hand, you know, it's nice to see representation out there in the media and do we have to do this? Like, but okay, I won't bring this back around to barbarians, right?
Yeah, we'll get there.
Because this is a show about kind of the visceral level of political life and the consequences of political decisions about who to side with and taxation and policy and political control and how that impacts the lives of these people. Like none of these people would be doing any of these things if it were not for Rome coming in there, right? This has set off a chain reaction of things that is going to change these people's lives forever, which is a great narrative push. That's so structurally well done in terms of writing a TV series. It's such a great inciting event to have. But also if that is indeed what this show is about, then these kinds of characters need to be realistically drawn and appropriately scummy. And I feel like that's one of the ways that this show has succeeded really well. Like these kinds of guys that we're talking about, these characters, these like villains and heroes, like people that you can find analogs for in real life, they need to be believable. And I think they are. And that's why I like the Varys constantly saying barbare, calling the guy a barbarian. It's like it's just so perfectly shitty a thing to do in a way that is authentically Roman. So I appreciate that also, characterization.
There's an element with the Varys relationship with that Segestes guy that like he doesn't like him because he's a barbarian, but that's kind of table stakes. But really why he doesn't like him is because he's a little bitch. Like there's that because when he talks to like the barbarian chiefs, he's like a bit disrespectful to them, but he's kind of like he's more like, well, you're like me from a completely different life. Like, you actually have a lot of the same responsibilities and priorities that I do. But that guy, he's like, you're a little fucking rat and you're useful to me, but I don't respect you as a type of guy over and above the fact that you're a barbarian.
That's true. I hadn't thought about it like that, but that's absolutely right. Like and in that case, calling him a barbarian is so deliciously derogatory because he knows that the guy understands him when he says that. And it's such a wonderful bit of characterization for them to do for the character, for Varys. And it helps make him like multidimensionally kind of shitty, which I appreciate. So like there's the grand overall imperial way in which he's bad, right? Because he's intruding in these people's lives and he's causing violence to them. He's going to extract from them taxes and tribute. Like he's making their lives worse in all of these ways, but he's also just kind of an asshole. Like, and that works so well as a villain because we think about like these great acts of evil, which a campaign of imperial conquest is at a basic level. It is inflicting violence on people who quite often have done nothing to you even at the most abstract level to deserve it. Right. Like,
and it does good to kind of actually depict how that works in practice in the sense of like, when you study these things, you know, that like the Romans are basically extracting resources from these places. Right. And then I think what this show does quite well, particularly in the first episode, is where they show the Romans doing this, where they're like, well, we want this much grain and this many cows. And then the villagers are like, we don't, they're like the Sopranos. It's like, they're like, well, we don't have that. And they're like, well, we're going to come back in 3 days and you're going to have it. Or we're going to find some other way of sorting this out. But there's no like, they're not like, we want to do violence to you. They're like, we want our shit, get our shit, or we do the violence. And there's this like a dispassionate element to it. But then you see how that the resource extraction of it goes alongside the violence and how those two things interact.
Yeah, they're completely intertwined with each other. And that was, again, I'm so glad you brought attention to that, because that occurred to me, and I'm not sure that Phoebe and I really got into it, is just the entirely quotidian aspects of it. Like when that guy hit the kid on the head with the pommel of his sword, that was something that guy had done a dozen times, right? Like that's the sense that you get watching that, is that these guys are here. It's another fucking village that they're going to get the five cows and the sacks of grain from. Like there is like one of them is probably going to sexually assault a woman from the village. Like somebody's probably going to get stabbed or punched in the face. Like they've done this 5 times that day. They've done it 100 times in the course of this campaign. It's just, that's the kind of, and then the idea is the next time you
and
won't
in
have
his
to
mind,
do
he's exercising control. Like, he's like, well, I didn't stab him.
Yeah.
He's like, that's like, he's like, I assessed that was reasonable force. Mm-hmm. So that's what I did. Like, and it's like, it's completely like, you see it in that way of like, it's sort of, it's banal, right? It's like, they're not, they have no desire to do violence particularly, but they also have no desire to not do it. Like it's completely, I'll be as violent as I need to be to achieve this.
Yep. And that is true by and large of violent people, no matter what period of history that you're looking at. I think it is, fair to characterize the ancient world with that as a defining factor or a defining feature. That kind of like quotidian daily use of violence to reinforce social hierarchies and get people to do things is, I mean, it's a facet of all ancient states. I think it reaches a really finely tuned form among the Greeks and Romans, which are both slave societies, right? Like, and we draw distinctions between societies that happen to have people in some form of unfreedom and societies that are defined by the presence of large numbers of enslaved people and kind of building some substantial aspect of the economy of your society on enslavement. So one of the things that does, not only does it mean that you're just regularly like using force or the threat of force to get people to do things because you own them as property. But that this attitude and these then becomes much more pervasive throughout society, that if you have people that you own as property, then you tend to think of all social relationships as involving some aspect of mastery and dominance, like somebody is being dominated by someone else. Like this idea is just pervasive in Roman society. And it's like a lot of what we actually know about slavery in the Roman world comes because Roman aristocrats who were trying to figure out how to understand the new emperor in their world in the first century AD wrote about that relationship in terms of slavery, in terms of a master and a mastered, right? Mm. So that, but if you have that in your society, this kind of routine resort to force to get people to do shit. And they didn't do it to their kids is the thing. Like there was the, like, while hitting kids was not like forbidden in the Roman world. Like if you lived in a household that had a slave and a child and like your free and your freeborn natural child, you would use violence against the slave, but not against your child. Like it was kind of frowned upon. Like you were supposed to guide your child with affection. That was kind of ideal Roman parenting, but you were always encouraged to use violence against the slave. So if you have that kind of relationship in your mind and this model of how you can relate to people, then it becomes much easier to do imperialism to them. Right. Because then you just have a model for like, some people are meant to be dominated. Some people are meant to give you shit. Like that's your role in the world.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting you bring that up. Like what it does to a society, like the presence of it. Cause I think honestly, and I've often thought about this, just like there's a kind of core difference between like European and American society. And I feel a lot of it comes down to the fact that like, a lot of the consequences of European empire were kept like outside of Europe and people didn't experience them. And I think that the fact of like living side by side with slavery and its consequences has like so irrevocably changed American society in a way that like is very difficult to understand. I think even for Americans, because it's so like priced in. And it's like, it's a strange thing to get your head around. Almost, it's like, it's easier to move on from something if you weren't present when it was being done.
Yeah. It's wild. And that, like, I think about this quite regularly, because there are some people who are completely unaware of it in American society, right? Like, they just go about their lives having zero awareness of the fact that this, like, monstrous crime is at the heart of how we organize American society and the reasons why a lot of things are the way they are. Like, not in the sense of it being a purely moral judgment, it's just a statement of fact that this is an incredibly influential thing in the development of American politics, legal systems, how American civil society comes into being, why people vote the way that they do, like the economic organization of different areas of the country, modes of extraction. But the big one is when you have had a racialized caste system in a country, right? When you have sorted people into different buckets of worth as human beings on the basis of some externally definable characteristic, that yes, that fucks with the way that you understand the world in a basic way. And that legacy is just everywhere in the United States. And and it's not just the kind of material consequences of that. It's also this mode of thought and idea of dominance that is baked in. Like, and if you know what you're looking for, you see it all the time. But you could, if you're a certain kind of person, you can go through life blissfully unaware of it, or pretend to be the victim of it.
It's always
a fun one. Yeah.
And I guess in Roman society, I mean, we've talked about this on this podcast before. It's sort of interesting because slavery is not racialized, really. Mm-hmm. Other than, like, slaves tend to be not Roman, but other than that, they're not of any particular ethnicity. And also, you can stop being a slave and you can become a citizen. And people who sometimes are, like, from relatively high up in society sometimes end up as being slaves or through all kinds of various chicanery. And so, that, again, it's that Roman, like, matter of factness. Like, it's like, well, you know, you're a slave now, but, you know, if you behave yourself, you could become a very powerful man eventually. Or, like, it's this sort of, like, there's this constant, like, violence and violence adjacent things being done. But they're also in this, like, it's done in this, like, no hard feelings kind of way. Like, oh, this is how the society operates.
Yeah, there are, like, it's, again, this is one of the ways in which, you know, kind of slaveholding and mastery provides a lens through which people understand this stuff. Like, there is an acceptable amount of violence that you can do. So a critique that you see of certain kinds of slave masters, and also this goes for emperors too, same critique gets applied to both kinds of people, is that it's okay to do a little bit of violence, but it becomes excessive. It becomes gauche to do too much. Like, beat slaves for minor infractions is a gauche thing to do. It's just not done. Like, it's much better to guide your slaves through words and to pretend to be interested in them and to make them feel like they're part of your family. Like, this is the right way to do things. And, you know, really what they're talking about is what they think the relationship between the emperor and the senators should be. But there's this, like, paternalistic model of slaveholding where, like, you know, sometimes you got to hit a kid to bring him back in line. Those are the two models that the Romans have, is that of the master and the slave, or that of the father and his children. Those are their two main ways of understanding the relationships between groups of people. And and in the context of both of those kinds of relationships, there's an acceptable amount of violence to do. Like, it's technically legal for a Roman father to kill his son if he's deemed to have committed an offense that is serious enough, right? That's legal.
The dream of every British newspaper columnist.
but frowned upon. Like, I don't think we actually know of any cases. While that's legal, and while that theoretically represents the limit of a Roman father's control over his family, that is not something that we know to have been done. So in practice, Roman parents are much more kind of indulgent, like, while the threat of violence is still there, you know?
Yeah. And it's probably telling in a way. I mean, we're going to have to wrap up, aren't we? But what's interesting, you know, you say that the father-son dynamic and the master-slave dynamic are their two ways of conceiving as of a relationship in some ways. And then if you stop being a slave, you effectively become a son. Like, you go straight into that paternalistic client relationship. It was like, well, that's the other type of thing that we have.
Yeah, those are your options. And if you, and that is the very Roman way of doing things. And very unlike the Greek way, is that you just do the right things and then you're Roman and you get to be part of the system. You get to buy in. You get to be like, sure, you're a freedman, but you don't have to go around talking about that. People aren't going to mention it usually because either they're freedmen or their parents were, or they have an uncle or an aunt or like whatever. Like, everybody knows former enslaved people, especially if you live in a city. You're never more than, even if you are a freed person, you are never more than one or two degrees away from someone else who is. Like, the world is just full of these kinds of people. There's some debate as to how far out into the countryside that goes, but that's kind of a separate issue. But you end up in these, the Romans are like, if you buy into this, if you are an enslaved person who behaves themselves and becomes free, you get to go on living your life as a good Roman. And that's the same deal they're going to offer to the people of Germania. Like, you pay your taxes, you're leading people, send their kids to be educated. Then you become one of us. That's
kind of the tension of this episode, isn't it? I mean, we're not really going to get into the plot. The plot's not really that important, but it's the fact that, you know, Ari has gone off and become Roman, and he's kind of transcended that sort of, like, you know, enslaved periphery barbarian style relationship with Rome, and he's moved into the kind of client type relationship with Rome, where now he's like, a you know, Varus is like his adopted father. There's quite like a strong sort of symbolism there, and therefore he's kind of an outcast with the German village.
Yeah, it's a really and that's the thing that I find so fascinating, and one of the things that I really like about this show is that that guy existed. Not just the actual historical character who did exist, I'm sure as we get toward the conclusion, we'll talk more about that. Not just that guy existed, but that type of guy existed. There were tons of children of highborn children of like tribal chiefs and local kings and like city councilors, if you're in the Greek East, who left home. Went and lived with a well-off Roman family, took up careers in the Roman world, and they just disappear into Roman elite society. And you would never know that these people had been born in Germania. The only way we know is that they put it on their tombstone, or so it's clearly something that they had with them. But they lived their entire lives as just an elite Roman, kind of drifting from place to place within this vast empire.
Yeah. Well, this has been great. Been a fun little chat. It's so good to talk about a show that's not dog shit.
I know. This is what Phoebe and I were talking about last night. Is like, it's so wild to have a show that does give you like fertile grounds to think with, and relationships and questions and like moral conundra, you know? It is a nice change.
Welcome to the Conundra Show. This is what we're into. Anyway, yeah, guys, thanks very much for listening. I believe this is a free one. So if you're a free subscriber, you can sign up to the Patreon. It's $5 a month. You get twice as much Masters of Our Domain. Instead of an episode every 2 weeks, you get an episode every week. More of this. I can't be clearer about what the product is. It's twice as much of this. that's the trade. That's the deal. If you're in Australia, I'm at the Melbourne Comedy Festival. I have so many tickets to sell over the course of like a month. So at any point between the 27th of March and the 20th of April, if you want to come and see me in Melbourne, please do that. Cheers, guys. Bye.
Take it easy. Bye-bye.